Welcome to Big Questions, an ongoing tour of the big questions of life presented by Winsome Media. Now let's get right to today's discussion with your hosts, John Quigley and Bill Cook.
Welcome back. We've been talking with Dr. Gary Habermas and Dr. Mike Hart.
Wow.
We've been given permission to call them Gary and Mike.
You might want to just reiterate some of those credentials for those who weren't with us last week.
Okay.
The credentials of Gary and Mikey.
There we go. Excellent.
Graduated preschool and...
That's right. Well, Mike's a friend, and Gary has several degrees.
Takes care of Mike's credibility.
Yeah, but he's
I'm
a friend.
I'm associated with him.
Good yeah, three. But he's yeah, a friend. He's a friend. Where does that leave me?
Yeah, I made no friends at all on that front, did I?
Oh, not at all.
For you listeners out there that weren't here last time, Dr. Habermas is a distinguished professor of apologetics and philosophy and the chair of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, and also has several degrees, a BRE, which is a Bachelor's of Religious Education from William Tyndale College.
Not a business reply envelope.
No, we covered that last time. We've sealed that whole issue. Master of Arts in Philosophical Theology from the University of Detroit, and as well, a PhD in History and Philosophy of Religion from Michigan State University. So as we get into talking about the historicity of the resurrection, Dr. Habermas, you've got some very impressive credentials to speak to this whole issue.
What amazes me is you're still a young man.
Very young. Very young.
And, of course, Mike Hart has his doctorate in jurisprudence and a Master of Arts degree in Christian apologetics from Liberty. And
well,
since here we have a...
Not quite.
Well, yeah.
Not quite.
Dissertation aside.
He did all the work.
Dissertation aside.
He did all the work and decided law was better.
We might mention for you listeners at this point, there is a little dynamic at play here. Mike was
dynamic.
A former student of Dr. Habermas. So you're listening in on a bit of a reunion here as we continue
after
this
about
discussion.
15 years, right. I think.
But not a right. Bitter reunion, a bit of a reunion.
Or
oh, no, they're throwing things at
you. I don't know. Yeah, well, if you hear crashes, you'll know that maybe either one could apply. But we ended last time on the whole issue of certainty and probability and how we can know. We talked a little bit about the Shroud of Turin and what degree of certainty you had with regards to that being an actual piece of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Give us a brief rundown of how we know things historically. How do historians decide what's real, what's not? Because you've got different opinions about the same time periods from different historians.
But just like you do, by the way, on other disciplines. I mean, take physics, for example. 7 or 8 schools of thought on what the best way to interpret physics is. So you always will have, back to your earlier comment, you'll always have interpretations about facts. We all want to categorize things. I mean, you know, just take politically. Before 1990, you had communism, you know, and you had the right way, you know, for Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So you got the data out there, but there's always, you have to put it into a interpretive system. In history, the best way to do, well, the way to do historiography is what I just properly call tools and rules.
For our listeners' sake, well, and for my sake, by historiography, you mean the method of doing history?
Right, and the more technical end of that is philosophy of history.
Okay.
And that's why I said earlier that in the dispute about the knowability of history, probably half the scholars who get involved in the argument are philosophers, and half of them are historians, because philosophers do philosophy of history, so they do the underpinnings of the discipline. In particular, I said to popularize this, I think the simplest way to say how you do historiography is that you apply tools and rules to events. Now, tools would look like we have eyewitnesses. If the event is less than 100 years old, you have eyewitnesses. I still remember in 1960, kind of a popular craze in this country. It was a centennial of the Civil War. And as I recall, there were a few Confederate soldiers who had fought and were still alive. Now, I'm guessing these guys were 5, 6, 7 years old and put a squirrel rifle over their shoulder and went off to battle and maybe saw, you know, something. But there was this craze with interviewing them. So, you know, up 100, 105, you know, everybody likes to talk to eyewitnesses. You were there? I can't believe this, you know. But when you get much further than that, you have to deal with documents. Okay. Third, you've got archaeology. And there, history is similar, as we said, to paleontology, geology. You have to put the pieces together. Just because you have a piece of pottery doesn't mean you solve the issue. You still have to talk in terms of who did this, what time frame, could have been brought to this location from somebody else at another location. It doesn't solve the issue. With those three, eyewitness, written, archaeological sources, you have to apply, as you do in all the inductive disciplines, you have to apply criticism.
Okay.
Something's not a given just because it's there. So you apply critical theory. Now, under critical theory, these are the tools I'm talking about. You've got an eyewitness, you've got a written source, and you've got, let's say, take the Civil War, and you've got, if it's Civil War, you might have some musket bullets, or you might have bayonets. You know, people have collections of those things.
Right, uniforms and...
Sure. Sure, and reenactments, you know, and what do you base that on? So there's three. But you have to apply criticism. Criticism is where the rules come in. The rules would be things like, well, all right, given that we have this piece of pottery or this source or this eyewitness investigation, what do I give first place to? Who do I give the, what I say is more important here? And so there's all kinds of rules, and unfortunately, very few people ever systematize these things. Somebody will do three over here and one over here and four over here. You can put them together, and some of the rules look like this. All things considered, the earliest sources are the best sources.
Okay.
All things considered, the eyewitness sources are the best sources. Now, those are major rules. Another method you use. Now, here again, here comes interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
But way I like to do the resurrection, anybody's read my stuff, you know, carefully, they know that my chief method is a third rule, and that is try to build a case where scholars to the right and left hold common grounds.
Okay.
The even you admit kind of argument. Finding facts in that rather large area of history where both can agree. And that's another principle. But here's some little principles. Enemy attestation is important. One historian says, Paul Meyer, Western Michigan University, he says, if you basically say, if I said about Bill, if I said, hey, look, this guy is a loser, he's a cheat, he's a scoundrel, he's not very good to his family, and I don't think he's got a very reputable practice, but I'll tell you one thing about the guy, he's brave.
Has he met you?
But if I said,
so this would be my wife
called ahead.
My wife. But see, if I said after all that, but Bill's brave, chances are you'd say, Habermas can't stand Bill, but you know what? If he thinks he's brave, he must be. So enemy attestation, of course, when you talk about the resurrection, you're talking about the Jews and the tomb was empty. That's enemy attestation. Or a principle often called the principle of embarrassment. Let's say all three of you are my closest friends, but...
I got it already.
Pardon?
The embarrassment thing.
Yeah, yeah. Mike hasn't called me for 15 years. You know.
But other than that, yeah.
Other than that. But when you admit something, see, it's like, my wife's a really good gal. She's this, and this. But, you know, sometimes she... Well, that's probably a pretty good insight. When you admit something weak about a friend or when you admit something good about an enemy, those are some other things. So I don't know how many. That's five or six. Those are rules. So you've got tools to which you apply rules, and the result is what we call history.
I want to come back to some of the conclusions that those tools and rules lead you to, but you'd mentioned that there are different historians who will, I guess, maybe prioritize some of those differently. How big of a role does bias play?
Oh, okay. We talked briefly about a little history of history, history of historiography, and we talked about those who said history was a hard science, those who said it was all interpretation, and the amalgamation today is there's both. There's real events out there, and there's a lot of interpretation. So since it's agreed to varying extents that both are present, everybody realizes bias is present. Everybody does, especially when you're talking about things like communism or Republican. Type of government, or are you from the North, are you from the South, or...
Right. There's a definite bias there.
Yeah, what party do you... Before you go any further, are you Republican? You know, it's that kind of stuff. Are you a Christian? Same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with recognizing to a certain extent that we all have an axe to grind, if that's a subjective quality. John, end of John chapter 20, says, many other things that Jesus do, many miracles that are not written in this book, but these are written so that you might... believe that Christ is the Son of God and that believing you might have life through his name. John had a theological axe to grind. Doesn't make him a loser. It just means he's got a perspective. But to pretend you don't have a perspective is ludicrous. Everybody has a perspective.
Right? Certainly one of the hinge biases in looking at the resurrection, the uniqueness of Christianity, depending upon, as you said, the linear view, and certainly the claims of Christ and the resurrection of Christ and the claims of the church regarding that. But the notion of can miracles happen or can't they? It seems to me that's a real hinge, that's a watershed bias that directs a lot of conclusions in terms of looking at the historical evidence for the resurrection.
Yeah, that's a philosophical issue, I would say. Now, it's certainly historical evidence and other evidence impinges on it, but you're probably talking about the philosophical pre-issue, meta-issue of whether these things are even possible and what
exactly
to do with the laws of nature. Yeah, and just basically, I'd say there's two ways a Christian can go after that, a Christian scholar. One way is to say, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. Yeah, I know, we don't see these things. They're not a dime a dozen in our world, but you gotta, don't say anything until you hear the other. It's like the kid, you know, it's a little child who says, don't say no until I tell you when I want to go to Johnny's house. Don't say no until you hear the evidence. One way to go after it is, I was skeptical too. But look at the data.
Right.
I've got enough. Okay, that's one. The other approach to say is if you think of Mount Everest and the rest of the Earth, that's how some critics, and you have to kind of appreciate their view, they don't see too many Mount Everest in everyday experience. Now, of course, there is one there. But they think miracles are more rare than Mount Everest. And they want to know that in this sea-level sort of existence, mm-hmm. how do you get these incredible events like Mount Everest? You're asking me to believe something, to go back to Ernst Troeltsch around the turn of the century, an historian and liberal theologian. I don't mean that pejoratively. He was part of German liberalism, which mm-hmm. is, that's their name for themselves. Troeltsch said, I don't accept something in history unless I see an analogy. And so I just don't see an event like this. One way to go about it is, well, there really is this great event. And now sometimes people are lying, you know. I'm not saying these are lies, but I mean some people think abominable snowmen and
sure.
right.
UFOs, they think they're lies or are falsehoods of some sort. But history is full of things that are established when someone looks at evidence. So that's one way. The other way is to say, well, I don't really like your analogy of Mount Everest and Earth, the rest of the terra firma here. Let's say that these two playing fields, let's bring Everest down a little bit and let's bring Earth up a little bit. And yes, miracles will always be special, but there were a lot of other things going around in the ancient world, and we see this kind of data today. Yes, the resurrection is really, really special, but there's a lot of things in this category that we can call miracles. And that's the other way to go after it. And I think, now this is a kind of a radical thesis, but I spoke at a church about a year ago, and my thesis, I took 2 weeks because this thing just evolved. But I want to do a lecture on, is God alive and well on planet Earth? Mm-hmm. And I came to the conclusion that except for a few major periods of outpouring in the Bible, you have to say Moses and company, mm-hmm. Elijah and Elisha, Jesus and the apostles. Except for those three major periods, I think that God's as active today, maybe more so. I mean, mm-hmm. there's more people and we've got more cameras. And I think God is more observably active today in the world that ever in history, except for those three periods. And I would even go back to those three periods and say, unless you were part of the children of Israel leaving Egypt, where they pretty much could see what they wanted to see for looking, right. There's the pillar, there's the yeah. fire, oh, look, the water. Even if you were around for Elijah and Elisha and Jesus and the apostles, I seriously doubt whether the majority of people at that time saw miracles.
Yeah, people tend to think that the Bible is just full of miracles as if it happened every day, but when you consider the span of time,
right.
that those took place, and they are fairly
now. People are going to ask for data here, and I'm going to have to be prepared to go back and say,
yeah,
it is a radical statement. And what I tried to do for 2 weeks was to develop, I think, 10 areas. Some of them I had some really hard case evidence, and I went through these things and researched them before, like the double blind we were talking about earlier, the double blind experiment done in a San Francisco hospital with almost 400 heart patients, where I wonder about the ethics of this every time I do it. Of the 400, almost 400 patients, half of them were prayed for. They went around and said, would you like to be prayed for? Would you like to be prayed for? Would you like to be prayed for? And a lot of these people aren't believers, but, you know, they're in rough shape, and they're saying, hey, a little prayer won't hurt.
Yeah.
half of them then, after saying, yes, pray for me, half of them were prayed for and half weren't. So what about the half that wanted prayer but didn't get it? But anyway, it was a double-blind experiment, so not even the doctor knew who was being prayed for, who didn't. I think he turned it over to his assistant. Anyway, the bottom line was, I believe they monitored 26 categories, and the people who were prayed for got statistically better. That's the key, statistically better, not this thing. Well, they got better. Statistically better in 21 out of 26 categories. So much so that before this thing was funded, as I recall the story, the doctor's boss said, will you seek to have this published even if it goes against prayer? And the guy sort of said, well, all right. He submitted the data, and it was published in the Southern Medical Journal, which I understand from a medical doctor friend of mine is a very prestigious journal.
Okay.
And the Pricey, right at the beginning, says, these results are in keeping with beliefs held by those of the historic Judeo-Christian faith. That's the Pricey to this medical article.
Mm. Yeah, I think Patrick Glynn mentions that in his book, God, the Evidence.
Yeah, I've bumped into that book, yeah.
The thing you're saying here that I think is interesting is, going back to your seaplane and Mount Everest example, you're really still talking. You're still talking about the fact that the resurrection of Jesus, for instance, is still, if not Mount Everest, really it still is Mount Everest. The point is, we don't live at sea level.
That's a good point.
You still have to have a substantial amount of specific evidence for Mount Everest because it's still higher than anything
else.
It's
still head and shoulders above the 21 out of 26 categories of prayer. You're definitely right, Mike. I think that's a great point. What you want to tell the guy, though, is, you think you're living at sea level, but you're living in an ignorance of a lot of other things that are going on. Mm-hmm. And so I think if I could argue, my point is to tell this guy, if supernatural things are common enough that you can find them in your own life, in your own time, and there are other data in Scripture, whatever examples you use. I mean, right now the miracles of Jesus are a hot topic. Guy just published, Graham Twelvetree just published a book, Miracles of Jesus, 400 plus pages, where he takes every miracle pericope in the Gospels and decides that the vast majority of them have the tools and rules approach. Mm-hmm. Most of them have significant 3-4 historical rules each, which say this is an historical account. And right now it's kind of in to say Jesus is a miracle worker. So again, you're raising that plane, right. But the resurrection on any plane is above it. I mean, you guys have talked to Bob Newman before. I think creation is probably the only thing you can compare to the Mount Everest of the resurrection. But I think resurrection is greater than creation because the resurrection, by definition, if it occurred, is a new creation. It's a higher step of. It's a greater manifestation of creation.
Okay. And bottom line is you can't dismiss a miracle just because you don't believe in miracles.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other issue. All I was saying so far is I can take the, well, you haven't seen anything yet, look at my evidence. Or let's raise the plane and say it's happening around you all the time, check it out. One more area, by the way, there, near-death experiences. I think that there are some highly evidenced cases of NDEs, and most thinking Americans, according to surveys, agree with something like this. I don't know what's caused their belief, but, you know, life after death is, 70-90% in the surveys. But here's my point. If there's life after death, then why are you objecting when I say I have specific evidence for a head and shoulders above that example? But if we already have an afterlife, we're not asking you to go from the desert to Mount Everest. Right. You know. So that's another good point. But you're right. There's still that philosophical bias, and there's a side that you want to say in great detail. There's just a lot here. But you want to say it is just not scientific. It's not good research to rule something out before you look at it. And you don't want anybody to do that in any research. Whether it's a journalist, a lawyer, a judge, a medical doctor. You don't want somebody guessing who's going to win the game, what kind of flu you have, what's the outcome of this case, is this guy a murderer, without looking at the data, and all other fields. And so I think it follows that even in religious matters, we can't be prejudiced against the data.
Even so, though, you've got every springtime, around Easter time and Christmas time, and there are, usually on the covers of some very popular magazines, you've got some new rulings coming out from a group called the Jesus Seminar, who are always reported as biblical scholars, historians and biblical scholars, who have pretty much taken the approach that there really isn't much, if anything at all, supernatural about the testimonies that we see in the Bible in terms of fact. There's myths added and whatnot. So they're starting from that bias. Are they working the rules differently, would you say?
I think they've got the same rules we do. And are very similar, to show that their volume, the five Gospels, which, by the way, the Jesus Seminar is just listed as one of the co-authors. It's like an old rock group, you know. It's like Herman's Hermits or Jerry and the Peacemakers. Right. I mean, this book is Hoover, Funk, and the Jesus Seminar. It's like there's a couple guys that were principally there and then the whole group. And I think they list 72 or 73 scholars. It's a big rock group. But 72 or 73 scholars in the back of this book and their credentials. Some of them do have good credentials. But in general, there's been a lot of backlash against that group. This doesn't mean they're wrong. Just a consideration. A lot of non-evangelicals are, let's say, moderates in biblical research. They're bothered by a lot of things. They're bothered that these guys call themselves middle of the road. What they do in front of the opening portion of the five Gospels, they say, we're not like these, parentheses, dummies on the right, which they call the televangelists. And we're not like the skeptics on the left who say Jesus never lived. Implication, we're centrist scholars. Well, what they're not telling you is...
That's a pretty big range.
Well, yeah, and what they're not telling you is that the guys on the left who say Jesus never lived, you struggle to get two or three names of reputable scholars.
Right.
So it's a very small minority over there. And what they don't tell you is that their centrist view is nudging down against that view over there. Now, this doesn't disprove them. It's just that right now, they're bothering a lot of people by saying we're centrist. But what I was going to say was, at the beginning of the book, they start out with 30-some, I think, theses, presuppositions they have. And a number of them are rules, like the ones I gave you. They've got the one for eyewitness data is great. Right. They like Paul. Early data is great. They know that. So they have a chart with the early. So they use these sorts of rules. And people do respect enemy attestation and friends who are critical of friends and principles like that, and the embarrassment principle. So they've got some of those same runs. They play on the same playing field. They evaluate the different evidence differently. But one thing I'll say here might intrigue you, but with scholars across the board, no matter how far to the left you go, let's go to the left of the Jesus Center and take some of these guys like G.A. Wells, who says Jesus never lived. Even those guys admit this principle. Paul is an eyewitness to what he believed was the resurrection appearance of Jesus, and other early Christians, especially the disciples of Jesus, they believed they saw the risen Jesus. That is almost a given from any person or group you're talking to. Reginald Fuller, translator for Rudolf Bultmann and an eminent New Testament scholar in his own right, says that the belief that the disciples saw the risen Jesus is a fact upon which both believers and unbelievers can agree. I think he calls it indisputable or nearly indisputable. Probably 99% of scholars. Because, see, the minute you ask that question about the kamikaze pilots in World War II, David Koresh's followers, Jim Jones's, even the UFO groups where they die, you know, they drink the poison and lay down and die. In every case, even if you disagree with these people, communists, if you disagree with them, what you say is, if they gave their life, they at least believed it. Everybody says that. They were at least sincere, brave people.
Mm-hmm.
They at least believed it. And so scholars give the same benefit to the disciples. They at least believed it.
Right.
And so now you have to talk about, even from the Jesus Seminar, if they will grant that something happened, the disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus. Robert Funk's new book, co-founder, Honest to Jesus, a few years old now. Mm-hmm. He starts out with a list of facts we can know. And he allows it. Something really happened, some experience the disciples thought were resurrection appearances.
But Wells, you said Wells doesn't even believe in the historical Jesus.
He thinks that either he didn't live, he never lived, or he's an obscure ancient figure. We don't even know what century he lived in.
I'm not sure what it means to say that you agree to say that the disciples believed they saw someone who rose but who never existed.
Okay. Well, Wells says either he never lived, or we don't know the century he lived. Nonetheless, there were guys running around in the first century who believed they saw this person alive after his death.
Okay.
Now, Wells might add, and some of these other guys might add, yeah, but there were people running around who thought they saw Isis because there was a cult of Isis and Osiris. And people who, see, whenever you hear this kind of an argument, they want to lower the playing field.
Right.
And they want to say, yeah, but this stuff's a dime a dozen. It's all over the place. And they will frequently say that. What they're not telling you is the ISIS is the best case. People who believe to see ISIS, they entered a temple in a state known as incubation. And it, just like it implies, isolation. These people were isolated, sensory deprivation, bodily deprivation. Mm-hmm. And even then, They didn't say ISIS appeared to me. In incubation, you have a dream of ISIS.
So like the movie Altered States, where the, you go into the tub and everything's closed all around you. And
that's a good point, because it's known today that either sensory deprivation or sensory deprivation or isolation both can cause hallucination states, mystical states.
Right.
But even then, they didn't say they saw ISIS.
Right.
They said they dreamed about ISIS. But these guys will say, yeah, but that's not rare. There's a lot of people who thought they saw gods. They'll just say that in passing, like, it's on a par. When you get in there and you...
Like it dismisses
it's
the
a pretty
whole
broad brush.
Yeah. It's very... It's not just wide brush. It's like non-factually wide brush. You want to say, have you guys researched this? It is not even close enough to even make the comparison. But they do it offhandedly, like, well, sure, the disciples believe they saw gods, but everybody believed that.
What you're saying is, if I'm reading you, is that... If you really look at history, there aren't any other examples where a group of people believed that they ate with, touched physically in a normal conscious state, an individual who had resurrected from the dead.
There's a few reports like that. I'll say this. I did an article a few years ago called Resurrection Claims in Non-Christian Religions, investigating that sort of thing. There are a few odd reports. However, none of them are evidenced. I think you said groups, right? Where groups did.
Yes.
All the cases I'm aware of are individuals. So you can always say fraud. You can say hallucination.
All right. Let's pick that up next time, because we're finally getting into the meat of this stuff here.
There you go.
I've been talking with Dr. Gary Habermas, who is the Department Chair of Philosophy and Religion at Liberty University, and it's been a pleasure. And looking forward to have you back with us next week.
We've got to have you back now. We're really getting rolling.
Great.
And Mike, you can come back with us?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
More high probabilities.
Join us next week.
Production of Winsome Media, building intelligent bridges to faith in Jesus Christ. For more information on Winsome Media, you can contact us at Winsome Media, P.O. Box 3388, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, 18017, or call us toll-free at 1-877-WIN-MEDIA. You can also check out our website at www.winsomemedia.org. And don't forget to tune in next time for more answers to big questions.